and welcome to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. We are recording today in the backyard of the Hermanson household and have all the kids with us, but they'll be taking off, some of them at least, soon to get some rest. I know the Johnston children may be going to the amusement park tomorrow, and I'm not sure what the Hermanson kids have in store, but they've been partying pretty hard. And so before they go, we're going to let them quickly say hello. Why don't we start with the youngest and we will work our way up. Edie, would you like to make your podcast debut? Tell us who you are and maybe a little bit of something about yourself.
Hi.
What's your name, Edie?
My name is Edie.
What grade are you in?
I'm in 4K.
And what were you just doing before this?
I was doing the bounce house. It's really fun.
Does it have a slide?
It has a slide.
Did you bounce and go on the slide?
We bounce and then we go on a slide, so.
Well, that sounds excellent. How do you feel about bedtime approaching, Edie?
I feel about bedtime like very good.
You feel good about bedtime.
So you're ready to head off with Mom to get your jammies on? All right.
And we have here as well, I think next youngest, if I'm not mistaken, would be Sophia. Sophia, you have been on the podcast before, but why don't you go ahead and say hello again.
Hi, I'm Sophia.
And Sophie, you're in a new grade now since we last recorded. Why don't you tell them nice and loudly what grade you're in now?
Second.
And what's your favorite class so far? All right, you look a little stumped. Sophie, what did you think about the bounce house? Did anybody make you unhappy in the bounce house?
Yes.
Who made you unhappy in the bounce house, Sophia?
Nick, because he kept making us get out.
You got to speak a little more loudly. What was he doing, hon?
He kept making us get out of the bounce house because he wanted to do like tricks and stuff like that.
Well, that was a little quiet, so he made you get out so he could do tricks. All right, that sounds like a rough night, but you did get some root beer and some other stuff, I know. Next, I know we think in age here, we have Allie, who is the resident legalist on the podcast. You may be familiar. Also has made sure that we realize we ought not eat babies. Allie, you still have that same stance about not eating babies?
Yes.
Yes. Why don't you just briefly introduce yourself again? You can give your name and how old you are. Maybe if you want to talk about what grade you're in now, you're in a new grade in a new school.
My name's Allie. I'm 8, and I'm in third grade.
Third grade. And what's your name again, Allie?
Allie.
Allie. And you're in third grade?
Yeah.
Very good. What did you do today? Did you go to the park after we ate?
Yes.
And what did you do at the park? Did you buy drugs?
No. No? Kind of just...
You join a gang?
No.
Did you find a big stick?
No.
What?
Did anybody find a big stick?
My mom did.
She did? How big do you think it is?
Like 3 yards.
Nice. So about 12 feet?
Yeah.
Excellent. What's your favorite class in school right now, Allie?
Literature.
Literature? What are you doing there?
We read books.
Nice. What book are you reading right now?
Well, I just finished Make Way for Ducklings.
Very good. And I think we might have for a little while longer with us two others going up in age now. Next would be... our sixth grader, is that correct?
Anna first.
Oh, I forgot we have Anna sitting. Sophie was blocking Anna here. Anna, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? What grade are you in now? Any subjects you're enjoying, things like that?
My name's Anna.
Nice and loud.
I'm in fourth grade, and my favorite subject is gym.
And what are you doing in gym class right now that you enjoy?
I don't know. We haven't really started anything. We just... been doing random things.
And what was your favorite thing at the park?
Probably playing with the frisbee.
Playing with the frisbee. And what did you think about the stick that you guys found?
It was really big.
It was really big. Well, that's always exciting when that happens. Anna, did you do anything fun this weekend?
I went to a friend's house.
And what'd you do there? Why don't you get nice and loud into the mic? What did you do at your friend's house?
I went to a bouncy house place, and I went to a gymnastics place.
And you went swimming? No, you did not. Well, that sounds like a fun weekend, and I guess now we make our way to our sixth grader. Is that right, sixth grader?
Yes.
It's been a little while. I think last time you were on, you were putting my eternal salvation in doubt. Anything exciting you have going on? You're in sixth grade now at a new school. Anything this weekend or in general been going on you'd like to share, Oliva?
Well, tomorrow we're going to our grandparents' place.
Which grandparents? Mom's or dad's?
Mom's side.
Mom's side?
And Friday night we went to our friend's house and stayed overnight.
Excellent. Did you stay up super late?
Yes.
Did you watch movies or anything?
One movie.
What movie?
A Cat in Paris.
A Cat in Paris?
Yes.
Where is Paris?
France?
Very. I didn't
Wrong,
know
it's
Paris,
in Texas.
Texas. Yeah, I was going to say. And so you had fun? What's your favorite subject in your new school?
I don't know.
But
they're all really short. Like, the longest class is, like, 30 minutes.
Well, that sounds nice. I wish my classes were 30 minutes. That brings us to the last Johnston. Nick is not around right now. He's here somewhere. But we will let our last guest, our seventh grader, say hello. Anything you'd like to say about school or anything in general?
Hi, I'm Ziggy. Yeah.
Well, we just figured we would give them a chance to say hello before some of them have to make their way home. It's been a fun day, a nice Sunday. Got to see each other at church, then I think got some work done and got to hang out over at the Hermanson house, so it was a fun time. Our episode today, we're taking a little while getting to it, we'll be talking about a work Peter suggested, someone he's done a fair amount of work with, and that is a work by Sir Francis Bacon. And Peter, if I'm not mistaken, I did read it, but we're out on the patio and I'm trying to get my light working. There we go. I believe the New Atlantis, which you wouldn't call it dystopian. I guess you would call it a
utopian. Yeah.
Short, less than 30 pages, I think it turned out being
printed
it off, and we'll link it for you. But the New Atlantis by Sir Francis Bacon, a very interesting piece. Some of you may find this hopefully interesting enough that you'd like to look it up and read it. It's an easy read, but kind of gives a nice view of how an important philosopher, and I think the father of the scientific method he's been called.
Yeah, some people call him that.
Kind of viewed what he thought the future might hold. And so with that, I don't know if we have our disclaimer pulled up anywhere.
Well, we don't,
to share
since
it.
Ben's not in the studio or the backyard, as the case may be here, maybe we can ask him to insert his own voice at this point with the disclaimer.
Yeah, and Ben, once again, is not protesting the show or anything of that nature. We got to spend some time talking with him after church. He's been busy with work and had some family stuff, so maybe we can get his voice in if he can splice himself in. Right here, Ben, is where you want to do it. That's your cue.
Right now.
Yep,
Ben, now.
Right, yeah,
now.
Here. And we will get the disclaimer in there. And we will leave some space, I guess, for that. Scripture narrative for the night, which is taken from the book of Revelation, St. John's Revelation, chapter 21, verses 1 through 4, where John writes, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away." And I think ever since the fall into sin, for pretty much as long as there's been a human race, there have been people who have utopian ideas. Those of you who have maybe read Sir Thomas More's Utopia, Utopia can mean no place or nowhere, right? This place that we know just doesn't exist and probably can't exist, that nevertheless reflects how we wish things would be. And we'll be talking a little bit about Sir Francis Bacon's picture of that as we get further along. But we can see this in many avenues of life. In fact, oftentimes people's politics will even be touched upon by this, whether they realize it or not. The idea of creating the utopian society where there will be no more suffering or no more sorrow, where our toil will be taken away, whatever the case may be. And it's just an ideal that's ingrained within human beings, I think, because we know we were created for something better. We were created and planted in a paradise before the fall, and we still have that sense of that in us and a yearning, a hope for a return. And so I think probably countless poems and books and movies have been written about these themes. And so as we get ready to talk a fair amount about utopian ideals with Sir Francis Bacon, just a reminder for us as Christians that our utopia is one that does exist. It's not a no place or a nowhere, but it is on the other side of a casket, perhaps, or should the Lord come first and call us, on the other side of that calling upon his return, that there will be no more sorrow, no more suffering, but in a paradise restored through the blood of the Lamb who has died and rose to give it to us. So as we kind of get into some of the wonderful ideas Sir Francis Bacon will have for how a just and a happy society might look, and he comes back to that theme, you know, the people of this place are happy, we will keep in mind that we do have a hope for a happiness that awaits, even if it is not in this life. I think I've joked before, perhaps one of the most heretical book titles I know of is Your Best Life Now. Maybe I should have used the account of the rich man and Lazarus, as we are reminded that our best life is yet to come, and it's ours in Christ Jesus, and it will be one that will exceed anything that Sir Thomas More or Sir Francis Bacon or anyone with utopian ideals can draw up, anyone on the political right or left, I even suppose. So with that, we will make our way into the free-for-all.
And we're back with the free-for-all, where we wrestle with the pressing questions of life and try to answer them once and for all. Today we are going to, we're into September here, so the last month of the baseball season, so we thought, well, we should kind of do a little bit of a wrap-up. I'm sure we'll come back to it when we get to postseason again, but, you know, things are starting to take shape, and so we'll kind of, you know, put a bow on this one a little bit at least. And then we're about to start the NFL season, so maybe give a kickoff with our thoughts on the NFL season, at least with our favorite teams. I don't think either of us or any of us here are experts on the MLB in general or the NFL in general. But, you know, we have thoughts about our own teams because fans always have thoughts, usually very rational, well-constructed thoughts that they will share only when asked, and not just because they want to talk about it. So let's start off. Wade, we'll start with the MLB season. How are your Detroit Tigers doing this year?
I suppose the silver lining for me would be that when we had Pastor Bordelon on and we both predicted what we thought would happen for the Tigers, I believe he put them at 500 or a little bit above, and I think I had said that I did not think they would reach 500. So if there's any silver lining, it's the fact that just possibly I have a situation in which I can tell Pastor Bordelon I was right and he was wrong.
So there's one of those in your life.
Yeah. They're currently 20 games under 500, 22 games out. By my count, there's 26 games left, so we can still hold out hope. But the fire sales have begun. We have traded a number of key players. J.D. Martinez a while ago, I believe, went to Arizona. Upton is now gone. And then JV, Justin Verlander, was just dealt to the Astros. So they're unloading a lot of contracts right now. And I think, well, they sent a letter to the fans the other day saying, you know, we're sorry and we are in full rebuild mode. While we're on the Tigers, Ziggy, as a Detroit fan, do you have any thoughts on where the Tigers are at right now?
I'm kind of sad because they're doing so bad. But I like the fact that they realize that and now they're just trading people away so they can rebuild. And I just looked it up and Upton went to the Angels, it looked like. So, I don't know.
So the Angels are better now? You're happy about that?
Yeah, and also the Brewers are better than the Tigers, and that's never good. So.
The although the Brewers are your second team, I think. The Johnson family's second team. Probably my wife's first team. I don't know. She got pretty into the Tigers when we lived in Michigan. But, I mean, I'm happy to see the Brewers do well. I suppose you are too, Ziggy?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Mom is Brewers' first team.
So the big question with the Brewers is they're in second place as we're recording, at least. That could change, but I suppose, theoretically.
And striking distance with a series with the Cubs coming up in which the Cubs dirtily kind of got an exemption to change the game time. But if this is correct on my phone here, they are sitting right now 3.5 games back. So with it, one good series can really change.
Yeah, no, and they've got two series with the Cubs. Cubs are in front of them, obviously. They got two series left, a 3-game and then a 4-game series. So there's definitely they're definitely within striking distance. They're also within striking distance of the second wild card spot. I think it's Arizona that's slipped a little bit here. So so there's definitely hope. And you know, we started off the season, and I said, at least I don't follow super close the MLB, but you know, I'm definitely interested. And I thought, well, they look like they're probably a year or two away from really being contenders. And so for this year, for them to really be in contention for the division, and the division hasn't been as good as I thought it was going to be. The Cubs stumbled out of the gate a little bit. But
you know, though, I was, to me, I wonder with that sometimes, because you look at the division and you have three teams above 500, you know, and Pittsburgh not way under. I think there's been a lot of beating up on each other.
Yeah,
too.
That's true. That's always the thing. When you see a division where there's not a big separation, where there's not two teams that are at like 300 or 400, you know, then you start saying, well, there's, you know, they're a victim of their own success as a division. So, yeah, I think that's probably true. I think the Cubs have underperformed where most expected them after, you know, winning the World Series and everything. But I'm happy about that. I'm never a Cubs fan.
They got hot. I think it's like a 7-game win streak or something they're on now. So it's been they struggled most of the year.
No,
I will just briefly note,
half.
I don't want to interrupt Peter, but we are at Peter's house and you can maybe hear the sirens in the background. I do think another tree branch is possibly fallen down.
It could be, or there may have been like reports of cracking in a tree, and
that,
so
that
they could
be
just preemptively.
I just personally, I hope
road.
They don't have to go through that again.
Wade's a little nervous being here in Wauwatosa. He knows the kind of problems that we have to deal with, and you know he's afraid he has to go home. He has to drive home, and you know what if a road's closed down or something like that? I think. So. We'll get through this, Wade.
I know that you mentioned last time that garbage can was knocked over, and I just hate to see
that
would do.
That was rough. A little soon to talk about that, Wade.
But you were mentioning, Peter, you know, the Cubs have recently just got hot lately. If I remember, you and Ben were kind of, I think it was Ben was saying, you know, it's a young team, you don't know what they have, it's hard to keep it up all year. And I think he's right in most circumstances, but to their credit, the Brewers are sitting, what, seven games above 500. They had one streak, if I'm remembering, where it got pretty rough.
Yeah, right after the All-Star break.
But they battled through.
They did. And and for a young team to be able to come back from that, I didn't know. You know, when they went into that slide, a little slide after the All-Star break, I thought, oh, here, this could be it. You know, young team, but also it's just kind of the Brewers, way. But, they've battled back. I'm totally impressed. I mean, I'm listening to more games and, you know, paying closer attention now for sure. My wife texted me earlier, said, hey, the Brewers are up, and, you know, and I checked and I said, yeah, the Cubs are down. And, you know, I mean, so it's getting to the fun time of the baseball season. And, you know, some people say the baseball season's too long, and yeah, you know, that might be the case. It's certainly true for me that when you get into to September, baseball gets really fun if your team's still in contention. But there's something about the, you know, watching a team go through the long season and then still have something left in the tank at the end. And you know, I don't know. I like that. I feel like it's. Yeah. I wouldn't shorten the baseball season.
Yeah, I remember about 10 years of that being the case. That I could enjoy that. And I will say it is exciting to see all the – I mean, I'll be fair. Milwaukee fans are always pretty good. Even in the down years, you see a fair amount of Milwaukee gear when you're out and around. But it's kind of fun to see the good vibes in the area over what the Brewers are doing. Although I will say you see the Packers gear coming out in force. I think NFL is always going to be king here. But it's good to see people geared up for the Brewers.
Yeah, some people have common sense around here, and other people are Packers fans. But, you know, we forgive them as Christians, even if we begrudge them as sports fans. So.
We are without Ben, where there's no Packer fans.
I know, it's easy to rail on them then.
Yeah, maybe that's a good segue to the NFL, and we'll maybe give Ziggy the first say. All right, I'm going to run a couple questions by you off the top of your head, Ziggy. You are doing fantasy football this year with your baseball team. This is my first year not doing it in a long time, so I've not done as much research as I oftentimes do. But off the top of your head, who wins the Super Bowl this year? You get 3 seconds. 1, 2.
Not the Patriots.
3. Pick.
Let's speak cataphatically and not apophatically, so we want a positive answer, that
yes.
means. Not a negative answer.
Make a guess. They're waiting.
The Falcons might make it back to the Super Bowl.
Okay, the Falcons are your pick.
Okay.
Falcons are your pick
to win it.
Well, then pick one.
A team.
Aliva, do you have a pick?
I don't really know, like, anything about football.
And then at least you know to admit it. Ziggy?
I saw this Sports Illustrated cover. It was that the Packers were going to win, and I was just like, nah.
Well, I think that might be something regional, maybe, that...
Which, like, literally, when do you not see that?
That's right,
yeah,
exactly. Right.
So if you're going to, Ziggy, who's going to win the division? Packers, Lions, Bears, or Vikings?
Packers, sadly.
Packers. Peter, who's going
to
win the division?
I want to say the Vikings.
Oh, Aliva says Vikings, in, yeah. But I think there's...
No, I said I want to say the Vikings.
I want to
that's
say.
That's just because I... Joke.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I mean, I want to say the Vikings too. Obviously, I think the Packers are maybe a little weaker than what people are expecting of them. The Bears obviously are out. I haven't paid attention to Detroit really, so I don't know. You can maybe tell me more on that. But
when are the Bears in?
Well, that's a good question. We go back to the '80s and
they have like a 13-3 year every few years.
That's right.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah. No, that great year. They won the last time they went to the Super Bowl.
Yep.
And they played the Arizona Cardinals.
And got smoked, if I remember.
And they beat them, but they beat them right at the end.
Oh, that's right.
And Denny Green, he gets up in the press conference afterwards, and he's all hot under the collar, and reporters are pressing him, and he says, "The Bears are who we thought they were. The Bears are who we thought they were."
I can't remember that now.
I thought, Denny, I'm with you. You know, you're right. They were who you thought they were. But yeah, they're not going to win. I guess I'd have to say if I was betting on it, I'd say the Packers. The Vikings, I'm nervous about them. There's a couple of holes. They got a lot of young talent and a lot of really good talent, but they got a couple of holes that I'm just afraid are going to be exploited. And by the end of the season, they're just going to be exposed, and everyone will know where to go.
I'm going to preface my answer by saying I've pretty much given up on my home team. I still watch the games, but I try not to get emotionally invested because it's kind of like an abusive relationship, and I just always end up hurt and less than I was before. That being said, I'm going to sound like a homer. I think the Lions are going to pull it off.
Really?
I think the Packers are... you look at the last few years, the slow starts, then they kind of get the ball bounces their way. There's the possible breeze from a thumb of a Lions defender, you know, coming within 3 inches of Aaron Rodgers' helmet that leads to the Hail Mary. I am going to say not the Packers. If not the Lions, I'm going to say not the Packers. I think the Bears could have a surprise season. Maybe this rookie, you know, turns out to be something huge. I think it's going to be someone else. You know, the Vikings came out strong last year. They had a setback at the quarterback situation, and then I think injuries just compounded. I think this could be a year where, like, a team goes 8-8 and wins it.
Yeah.
And if there's ever a team that's going to go 8-8 and win it, I think my Lions,
Lions can
go 8-8. if a team goes better than 8-8 and wins it, probably not my Lions. Matthew Stafford just got paid.
He did.
I'd love to see. I think that's going to motivate him to come out big time, try to prove a point. I'm talking myself out of the Lions pick. You know, I'm going to say the Bears.
Yeah, I was going to say that's, you know,
it's the
Bears.
I'm going to say a surprise year out of the Bears that they have one of those years where they have like 12 kickoff return or punt return touchdowns. Or, like, weird fumble recoveries, you know, where they're, like, plus 20 in turnovers. But I'm going to say I don't think it's going to be the Packers have been had to go down to the wire the last few years, and then they've kind of just laid eggs in the playoffs. Don't get me wrong. I still think Aaron Rodgers is far and away the best quarterback in the league. I think Mike McCarthy is underrated as a coach. I sometimes get a kick out of listening to the sports radio out here. How quickly everybody's ready to fire everybody. I mean, last year there were people talking about getting rid of Rodgers or he's past his prime. I just think they've had areas where they get pretty thin, and I'm curious to see how that will – you know, they took 10 offensive linemen, if I'm not mistaken, and 5 receivers.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's just – we'll see. I'm going to say not the Packers.
Yeah, no. Well, let's...
I feel like you're just saying the Bears because that if they do win, you're going to be, like, the only one who ever believed that.
Well, there's people south of here that would believe that.
Yeah, there's some people in Chicago that will always believe that.
Yep.
No, they won't.
Okay.
Oliva, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts is that I want to ask a question.
Okay.
So I hear all this stuff about injuries. If it were possible that nobody got injured, who do you think would win?
The Packers, I would say.
Yeah, I would. I mean, if it were no injuries, I would say the Packers or the Vikings. The Vikings are, I think, have, you know, a lot of good strength along the starting lineup. They just don't have a lot of depth. But I think the Packers are kind of similar. I mean, I think they've got some big
holes. I think that's been the last
holes.
Few years is there's not a lot of depth after you get past, you know, the start. And that's where 5 wide receivers and a system that just runs with a bunch. If no one loses a player, I think the Packers clean up.
It's hard to bet against Rodgers in that situation.
Yeah. But they have had a lot of injuries.
So the Vikings and Packers are hoping for no injuries. And the Bears are hoping that the Vikings and Packers get injuries. Yeah.
I think every team hopes for no injuries on their own team.
On their own team.
Yeah. Right.
All right, Ziggy, we'll go around each for our own team. Predict the record for your Detroit Lions.
Well, with the Lions, it seems like they always have a good year where they make the playoffs and then a trash year. And playoffs again and then bad. So this year, I'm going to say 7-9.
Oliva, would you like to make a prediction for your Vikings?
What does 7-9
mean? 16 total games.
So 7 wins, 9 losses.
How many games will they win out of 16?
Oh, okay. I really don't know.
More than 8 or less than 8 or 8?
I'm going to hope 8 or more than 8.
Okay. We're going to say you're saying 8-8. Peter, your prediction for your Vikings.
Vikings, I'm going to be optimistic and say 10-6. I think they'll get in if the Packers don't take the division. I think the Vikings, if they stumble, Vikings take the division with that. Otherwise, they get a wild card.
I'm going to say Lions, in keeping with my prediction, if they win it, 8-8. And I won't be happy with that. I do think they have had as much talent as anybody else, for the most part, that's not the Patriots or one of the very elite teams. But I'm going to say 8-8. Ziggy, you said, was it the Falcons for your Super Bowl team?
I don't know who's going to win the Super Bowl.
I'm going to say Patriots win it again.
I think the Falcons are going to make it, but not win it.
All right. And Peter, do you have a Super Bowl pick?
I don't. I haven't paid attention. I don't pay attention enough to other teams until the season starts, so I don't know. don't know who else is out there. I mean, Patriots is always a safe one, I guess. But, yeah, that's boring, so well, I'll just skip it.
No one really wins the Super Bowl 2 years in a row. So they have a huge chip on their shoulder if they're going to win it.
Well, that's true. But no one wins the Super Bowl when they're behind by, you know, like more than 14 points,
that's
too.
True. Or on the final play where Seattle chooses to pass.
That, too.
Yeah. All right, well, anything else?
Or if their, you know, team is in Minnesota, that's another
true.
Place.
Or Detroit.
In fact, I just thought of this. The Super Bowl's in Minnesota this year. Maybe no team will win the Super Bowl because you can't win a Super Bowl in Minnesota.
Huh. Maybe we'll have to drive out to Minnesota taking the pre-Super Bowl festive. Yeah. When it was in Detroit, it was actually pretty fun to take in all the stuff.
We were down in Dallas-Fort Worth when the Packers played down there and played the Steelers. And my brother-in-law drove down from Wisconsin just to hang out. He didn't go to the game, but just to hang out. And he loved it. So
yeah, it is a lot of fun. With that, anything else you guys have, or we'll make our way into the... we have sirens again, and I really... It is not a good day for tree branches. I hope I hope everything's going to be all right.
That definitely sounds like a tree branch problem.
Yeah. Anything else? Otherwise, we'll make our way to the main topic.
With the whole no one has injuries thing, I think the Vikings probably would take the division because last year, what were they, 7-0, 6-0? And then they got injuries and they did horrible.
Yeah, they didn't start undefeated like that. I can't remember how, like, I think they had three games and then they had a loss, but they started really strong, like 6-2 or something like that.
The Bridgewater injury in practice, that sounds like one of the more brutal injuries I've ever heard of, just from the reports of it. That really changed their year, too.
Yeah, no, and the big problem for the Vikings was their offensive line. They just went through, I mean, they were calling offensive linemen from the grocery store and saying, hey, you still want to play? So it was pretty ugly, so...
I bet that wasn't from the tofu soy milk aisle.
No.
Right, in the meats.
In the meats, yeah.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, with that, we'll make our way into the main topic. Us to our main topic of the day. We enjoyed doing David Foster Wallace's Consider the Lobster 2 episodes ago, if I'm remembering correctly. And so we decided, since we didn't have Ben and we didn't have a guest lined up, we're recording over the Labor Day weekend, to go ahead and pick another work to consider. And Peter had suggested, he's done a lot of work with Sir Francis Bacon's works in philosophy, and suggested this short utopian work of fiction. Obviously, utopian would align with fiction, The New Atlantis by Sir Francis Bacon. And so maybe before we delve too deeply into that and the story of that, Peter, you could give us all, I know I could benefit from it as well. I did research him a little bit to get context, but not too much. A little bit about who Sir Francis Bacon was, maybe why your interest in him, and then maybe how this fits in with his general thought or work.
Sure, yeah. So in graduate school, I did some work with Bacon, and it was delicious, but not that kind of bacon. He's an early modern philosopher. And he lives, his dates are 1561 to 1626, so end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century. He and René Descartes are oftentimes kind of seen, at least in philosophical circles, as the first modern philosophers in the sense of pushing towards modern science.
René Descartes, is that, I think, therefore,
I am? The cogito, cogito ergo sum, there you go. I'm freaking it out. I worked with Descartes and Bacon looking at that transition into early modern philosophy and really science. When I say philosophy, I do mean that, but this is the transition that happens there is what we think of now as modern science. And so
and you say early modern, Peter, and just maybe to give an idea for people, we're talking Reformation era, or a little before that, till the Enlightenment, French Revolution, American Revolution period,
right.
Probably.
Yeah, perfect. That's actually great. I should remember that because people ask me, and then I just kind of give them a century and say, well, that, you know when that is, right? So that's good, yeah. There's a lot of changes going on in Europe, and one of the one of the things that we know of course would be the Reformation, and philosophy there's also a lot of changes going on, and what comes out of it is modern science. And when we think of the scientific method, this is the time when that starts really kind of coming into focus. That's not to say that people weren't doing science before in any sense, but it takes a very distinctly I would say modern turn, and we call it modern now because we look back and can say that. But modern's kind of a funny word, too. I think in Latin it means just now. So we say modern, and we're talking about the past and the distant past. In this case, it's kind of funny, but so such is language. So at any rate, Bacon was a really bright kid. At age of 12, he started at Trinity College, had a lot to offer. He was more of a politician than anything for the first part of his life. He was... born into status in England, so he's an Englishman, but he was left with very little money, so he ends up kind of having to be like a wealthy beggar in sense, and he asks, I believe it's his uncle, to help him get a position in the government, and he doesn't, his uncle's not helpful in that regard, and so he kind of goes out and has to do it on his own. He makes his way all the way up to the Lord Chancellorship, which I'm not British, so I don't know exactly what that means, although I know it's a very high position in the British government. But he leaves that position, or is removed from that position in disgrace, because he was accused of accepting bribes and was impeached by the Parliament. Now, there's some debate about whether or not he actually accepted the bribes. Some people say that it was concocted to cover someone else who was accepting bribes, and so they were going to pin it on Bacon instead. I don't know the history and the situation surrounding that enough, other than just to know that historians disagree on whether or not he actually was.
Do you think
corrupt.
He did it, Peter?
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm saying.
I think he did.
Here's the what's that? What's that, Ziggy?
He did it.
Okay, Ziggy says he did it. Oliva, do you think he did it?
I'm just gonna say no, just to contradict.
Did Bacon take the bribes?
No.
No.
Okay. And what do you think?
I'm just looking. I'm gonna say I think he did it, but only because one of the YouTube videos I watched, it like one of the like 60 or 90 minute biographies,
yeah.
said that he did it.
It's.
I thought you didn't like YouTube.
Well, I said there's YouTube celebrities who are problematic, but for documentaries, I found a 60 second biography, Oliva. Knowledge.
60 seconds.
I tried to find a 60-second Bible, and I couldn't.
60 seconds.
Can you give me a yeet?
Yeet.
So, I don't know if he did it or not. In the end, it doesn't matter, except that if he didn't do it and he weren't accused, we may not have all of his philosophical writings, because what happens is he's removed and he ends up, I can't remember how long he gets sent to the Tower of London, but he gets a huge fine and then gets, imprisoned in the Tower of London, but then everything kind of gets reduced. His fine goes away, and I think he spent like 4 years or something like that, imprisonment, although I don't know.
Right, this wasn't like Trump Towers. Like, the Tower of London was...
It's a little different.
My dissertation, when I covered John Hooper, contrary to, it sounds like a very nice place, not a nice place.
Not a nice place.
Not a nice place.
So at any rate, he leaves there and that's when he really starts getting in writing his philosophical works after that. And so the works that I was looking at and that he's kind of most famous for, comes after that. He really dedicates himself to his philosophical writing. So for that, I'm grateful whether he did it or not. I'm kind of grateful he was accused.
He did it.
He did it. He probably did it.
Definitely did it.
What's he doing then? Why was I interested in him? He's
Peter, be honest, at first you were interested in him because his name is Bacon.
Well, at first I was just like, hey, this sounds delicious. And yeah, I started looking into it, and then I realized it didn't taste as good, but but it was still interesting. So no, when people would ask me, this is what I'd never finished my dissertation, but this is what I was working, what I was doing it on. And I, when people would ask me, what are you doing your dissertation on? I love just telling them bacon. And they'd look at me very confused. So
it was Texas though. So they maybe thought you were doing ag stuff.
Yeah. Oh, bacon. I got some good cows too.
No, I like right. Bacon.
Bacon, his the way he changes what he's doing is philosophy. But I think we talked about this with Carrie with Dr. Keene in a previous episode. Philosophy at this time, natural philosophy, is what becomes science. And so he's really pushing in a different direction for natural philosophy.
And natural science, I believe Dr. Keene mentioned, is what it would be called at that point for the sciences we're doing now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Science means wisdom, right? Scientia means wisdom. And so you've got this strange thing. You've got philosophy in Greek means lover, lover of wisdom or love of wisdom. Science in Latin means wisdom. So it's all about kind of, you can see where the connection is, but we don't think about it that way. I don't think, at least from my perspective, we often think science is something different that has test tubes and Bunsen burners and, chlamydia research, radioactive and whatnot, and otherwise.
Reference to our episode coming out soon with Dr. Henkel.
Yes, episode 23, letthebirdfly.com/23 if you're looking for that one.
This reminds me, Peter, so I taught on Consider the Lobster from our last episode in ethics this week.
Yeah. Do tell.
And so I asked how many students had eaten lobster, and then I asked how many had boiled them in their home, and there were four who sheepishly raised their hand, and so I quizzed them about, did it squeal? Did it try to get out? And the one said, yeah, it clunked around for a while, but then it stopped. And the other said, it sounded a little bit like a teapot.
Yeah, that's
and
what
so
I've
been arguing for a long time that theology and philosophy should have labs.
Oh,
and
here we go.
I came up with the idea, we could go over to Generac and use a Bunsen burner.
I remember that.
For ethics. So we could go test out what happens when you boil the lobster.
Right.
And then see if we feel like it's ethical.
And then taste it, right?
Right, just possibly,
if we feel okay about that.
Yeah. But sorry, so you're back to Bunsen burners.
Yeah.
And
So lobster, we do these episodes alone and we talk about lobster and then bacon. I think, Ben's got to rescue us here one of these days.
You know what probably would be good? Bacon-filled lobster.
Or...
You couldn't wrap the lobster because you got to break it open.
Well, but you could pull that. You could have them together, and then you could wrap your bacon around your lobster.
I think lobster bacon wraps.
There you go. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sorry. So I'm sorry. You were talking about the development of science.
So bacon's looking at changing science changing philosophy. Excuse me, in a very real way. And remember, philosophy would just mean human thought, wisdom. Just kind of thinking about the world around us or people, society, these sorts of things. So it's very broad. But he's looking at it and saying, how can we understand the world around us? And he wants to vex nature is one of his things. Nature vexed will tell us her secrets, right? So he wants to take nature and, nature usually referred to as a feminine here only because in Latin it's a feminine noun. So, but wants to bend nature and twist her to reveal her secrets. And this is a change. This isn't just observational. This isn't categorizing things like Aristotle would do. And in fact, some of his philosophical titles give this away. Aristotle's corpus, his writings, are known as the organum, the works, or the work, right? The body of his work. And Bacon writes a book called the Novum Organum, right? So the new work, so the new body of work. And this isn't a coincidence. He knows exactly what he's doing. He also writes the Great Instauration or the Instauratio Magna. So Instauration being a new beginning, right? So the great new beginning. And he writes the Advancement of Learning. All these titles that just, it's all about moving forward. It's progress in the sense that we think of progress, in the sense that we think of science giving us progress. And the way he sees that this will work. Is through cooperative research of sorts. He thinks what we're missing is data. We need people to come together and just do the research, do the experimentations, and record the data. And if they can do that, then we can put that data together and start making sense out of it. So, for modern ears, this might seem like, of course, that's nothing big. This is huge. He's basically saying, you don't follow Aristotle or Plato or whoever you might follow. You don't follow the great master because then you can only reach to the certain height. You can go to as high as they've gone, but no farther. He's saying if we do this together and we do this as a cooperative, a corporate project, we can actually understand nature and start getting her to reveal those secrets to us. So why do we want nature to reveal those secrets? Well, because we can make life better. We can make it happier, more comfortable, and here's the big one, longer, and maybe, just maybe, we can even overcome death.
And one of the shifts, if I am correct, Peter, is moving from Aristotle and the tradition of deductive reasoning with Bacon now to inductive reasoning. We're going to examine a number of things. We're going to, you know, look at data and then try to draw conclusions from that.
Yeah, and you have to be a little careful with that, and I'll try not to get too deep into the weeds, but at the same time as Bacon, I mean, a contemporary of Bacon is René Descartes. He's across the channel in France, and he's a champion of deductive, you know, the deductive method, and he's very much, in fact, I would say, depending on what discipline you're in, some people would say he's the father of modernity, probably in philosophy. There's more of that in science. It kind of goes back and forth with Bacon. It kind of goes through waves. Sometimes people think he was just the single most important person. Sometimes they kind of forget about him altogether. But the point is that Descartes is championing, you know, the other major method of deduction at the same time that Bacon is saying induction. And if you read Bacon carefully, he's not just saying induction in kind of the normal historical sense. He's saying very clearly, and he says it in his writings a couple of times, my deduction, or this kind of deduction, or I'm sorry, induction. Let me explain to you what this induction is, and then he goes through the steps. So it's a little bit more complicated, you know, in my opinion. But in general, yes, and I think it's not wrong to say he's championing induction, which is a change. But that in itself is not the biggest change, I think, that results or points to modern science.
Well, I was reading today for the History of the Reformation course I teach, and I use the Obermann Luther Man Between God and the Devil biography.
That's a great book. Yeah, we talked about that some other time. You mentioned it. That's just a great book.
Yeah, and it talks in there about nominalism in the via or via antiqua and moderna, and how, just briefly, nominalism, you know, is that we give names to things that we kind of, rather than focusing on universals, right, this idea of personal experience plays into where we name things we come across. And Obermann just has the line in there, is once experience, or how about this, nominalism was a major factor in the advance of both the natural sciences and theology. Subordinating speculation to experience freed physics from the confining grip of metaphysical systems that transcended experience. Once experience became experiments, modern science was born, and it was nominalism, not humanism, that had paved the way. And I guess with that, I don't want to get lost in nominalism, but just to show, you know, you have this trend that's somewhat developing of, and it's not, I mean, Aristotle also says we should look at the world around us to figure things out.
Yeah, definitely.
But just this move towards, I don't know, maybe you can say it better than me, but just there's a realization, or we're stumbling towards this idea that, yes, we're not devaluing the past, because Bacon's a Christian. He obviously thinks the scriptures are important, and the nominalists obviously thought the scriptures were important, and they had, you know, they didn't toss out the past. But the idea that there was maybe something to press forward toward, too, we're not just recapturing a bygone era. You know, there's things we're experiencing. There's data, I guess is the phrase you used. Not that anyone at Luther's time necessarily would have been talking about it yeah. that way, but that there's things to be found out from that, right?
Yeah. No, I think that's accurate, and I think that there's this idea that that we are learning from nature in a way that that we're reading nature passively is maybe what, you know, in the West at least, is the method that had been followed primarily. And at the turn of this modern era, with people like Bacon and Descartes, it changes where we say, let's read it actively, much more actively. Let's get in there and dissect things in a literal sense. I mean, Descartes was, I mean, there's stories, I don't know if they're true or not, but there's stories that have been told ever since the time of Descartes that he would, you know, do a lot of dissecting of cadavers, human cadavers, and things, and that he had mechanical a mechanical person that he was trying to work on and trying to work out all the, you know, the pulleys and things to make it work and all of this stuff. But the point is that he saw it as, he saw nature as something that you could tear apart and take a look at on that, you know, well, we would say, I mean, literally a microscopic level, but he was saying, let's look at all these little components. How do they go together? How does it work? And he saw it very mechanically, whereas the ancients and most the way, almost all the way up to the modern era, you look, the general approach, and different people, there's of course exceptions to this, but for the general approach is, we're going to look at it and we're going to let nature teach us, kind of in a more passive sense. We're going to try to read the book rather than write the book. So yeah, there's that huge change coming, and Bacon is a huge part of that. I mentioned that some people have said that he's the most important person in the formation of modern science. Some of those people you may have heard of, people like Leibniz. He was a Lutheran, by the way, but he's a philosopher. Rousseau, we talked about him. Castro, I can't remember. Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
French Enlightenment.
Yeah, French Enlightenment. Immanuel Kant, he grew up as the son of a Pietist Lutheran pastor, I believe.
Right? And then he tried to kind of rescue God's law by grounding it in reason.
Right,
yeah.
And I think my philosophy professor in undergrad, Professor Teigen, he said that he believes he got buried like in the under the wall of the church. So they got him halfway in the church in his death, at least. So. And then another one would be Thomas Jefferson, which many of our listeners might have heard of. Now, not everyone agreed that Bacon was the single most important person in the formation of modern science. Dignitaries such as David Hume, for instance, disagreed.
Not a fan, yeah.
Said, no, this is hooey. But the point is, there are plenty of people throughout history who have pointed to him and said, this was a significant change. So,
and if I'm not mistaken,
I should say,
go ahead, Peter.
There are some people that have argued that he is actually one of the authors of some of the Shakespearean works.
I have seen that too. You know, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, part of Hume's critique of Bacon is, I think, I mean, it is a critique of some of what Bacon's saying, but I think more maybe just kind of chastising too much optimism that might come out of it. I mean, Hume is saying the sun has risen every day, but that doesn't mean it's going to rise tomorrow. I would say most of us would be willing to bet if someone has noticed it's risen every day for thousands of years, we're going to gamble on it. And I think, you know, well,
and,
yes.
And Hume wouldn't say that was necessarily a bad gamble.
Right.
But what Hume is doing, I love Hume, he's being consistent, right?
Right.
And he's saying, but there's no real causation that you can show here. There's no reason that you have to believe that other than your experience, other than recorded history, right? Well, that's completely the opposite of Bacon. Bacon's saying, you know, you should believe your experience, and the repeatability of experiments in modern science is absolutely essential. If you don't have that, what do you do for experiments in modern science, right?
Right.
And that's what Bacon is pointing to, and he's one of the forerunners of that method. Well, Hume is basically calling the whole method into question, and he's saying, well, it might work fine for you, but where's the principle upon which you're founding this? And if you stop and really give that, and don't just kind of dismiss it and say, well, that's stupid, you know, I mean, like,
right.
Of course the pen is going to fall because I drop it, because it always does, but you say, but why is it? That's when you start getting some really interesting questions, and Hume drives you to a really kind of uncomfortable place. Speaking of Kant, he said of Hume, that Hume awoke him from his dogmatic slumber, right? I mean, like, so again, Kant is no small name in philosophical circles, and he's got great praise for Hume.
I just think the American utilitarian view is kind of going to be that's great, Mr. Hume, but this seems to be working fine. experimenting and taking for granted. I mean, operationally, I think. Maybe, I mean, Hume, I respect Hume's point, but I think as far as for influencing how people tend to operate, there's a lot to what Hobbes has to say.
Yes, yeah, no, and we're getting pretty far afield here. We haven't even gotten to the new Atlantis.
Yeah, maybe
yet.
We should just briefly introduce.
So I think this is helpful.
The reason for the work, maybe.
Yeah, no, and I think this background's helpful because you need to understand. I mean, so this is a utopian novel, but it's not. I mean, when you read it, it's definitely written. Oh, I should say, Bacon is a good writer. I don't think he's actually wrote any of Shakespeare's, and very few people actually believe that anymore. But Bacon, acolytes like to bring that out every once in a while and point that out. So, but he's a good writer. But I would say when you read this, you realize this isn't exactly Shakespeare. But he's telling a story, but it's not just a novel or a novella. He's trying to teach you a lesson, or you can tell there's a bigger point behind this. So as you read it, you realize, okay, well, what are we getting to? And you should always be asking that when you're reading anything that's worth reading. But in this case, you're asking philosophical questions. So he writes this work, and it's a story of some sailors that they set out, if I remember correctly, from Peru. So this is, of course, after the Americas have been discovered, and they're sailing through the Pacific, north in Peru, and they hit some bad weather, and they get blown way off course, and they have no idea where they are, and they're about to give up for lost, and they're praying to God to have mercy on them as they expect themselves to die, and then all of a sudden they see land, and the land turns out to be this this island of Ben Salem. And they reach Ben Salem, and the Ben Salemites don't want them to come on shore, and they send out group of people to tell them, don't land. So you can stay here and repair your ships, but don't come ashore. And they tell them, but we're really sick. We can't survive if we can't come ashore. And so they eventually let them come ashore. And then the story is about them staying there and how they're treated. And in Ben Salem, they haven't had visitors for, do you remember how long it had been? It had been way, way too long.
It had been decades, if I'm not mistaken, because they'd been able to save up funds for the Stranger House.
Stranger House.
If I'm not mistaken, I'll just add in, I'm guessing Ben Salem is supposed to be a play on the Hebrew.
Yeah, I was going to
Ben for son, like Benjamin, son of my right hand, and then Salem Peace, the sons of peace, I would guess.
Son of peace, and there's a lot of play on that. And in fact, one of the main characters in Ben Salem is a Jew. I forget his name now. Do you remember his name?
I don't off the top of my head.
But no, and so there's a lot of play on Hebrew words. In fact, the structure of Ben Salem is they've got this very peaceful society, and everyone's very happy, and it's very advanced, technologically, scientifically advanced. And at the center, they have what they call Salomon's House. And there's a discussion about, like, why is it called Salomon's House? Well, it sounds like, Solomon, of course. And so some people say, well, it's supposed to be Solomon's House, Solomon being the wisest, King David's son, wisest man, ever to live, according to scripture. And so they're saying, well, that's what it's supposed to be. But they had the founder of the laws of Ben Salem. His name was Salamona. So it was, maybe some people said it should have been Salamona's house. And it's interesting that Bacon throws this in here. Like, there's this confusion about, like, which way, like, what should this be? And I'm always wonder, like, when I'm reading things like this, I wonder, like, so why is Bacon putting it there? Is he writing that because he just wants it to be more interesting? It'll be pretty dry. And if he says, this is how this works and this is this, but, and so he's just trying to make it seem a little more real. Or is there something that he's trying to draw our attention to and saying, hey, there's, this, Salomon's house, it's all kind of shrouded in myth, right? So what's the why is myth necessary for this scientific house? So at Salomon's house, this is where they have all their scientists that are doing their experiments, and the whole last probably third of the book are just discussing the sorts of experiments that they do.
Well, and I kind of took it possibly, and I could be wrong because this is the first I've read much of him, but also possibly the names being connected, in that you have this wise king who is willing to appropriate the wisdom of the past, and then but also want to build upon it, right? So there's kind of like this tradition. I mean, you read Solomon in the Bible, and Solomon is doing, I don't know that we'd call it scientific inquiry, but he is trying to explore nature and the world. And so maybe kind of this idea of, look at this people who have their own wise leader who wants to do the same, to appreciate the past, appropriate the past, but then also go forth and explore more. But I'm probably reading into it there.
I think that those are the questions Bacon wants us to be asking. And relatedly to that, when we see the way this I should step back a minute, just a step here. The way that the island becomes Christianized is again through something of a myth, right? Or of a,
and in a very Protestant fashion. I'll let Peter keep going.
So they have this some sort of ark or boat is floating and glowing, and they row out to it. And this is, you know, ancient history for them. But their people row out to it, and their boats get stuck, and they can't get any closer. And they sit there, and I don't remember exactly how long, but they sit there for a while. And then finally one of the leaders offers up a prayer to God, kind of a humble prayer. And it's just very...
And kind of very much like, you know, in the tradition of the eunuch with Philip, or with, you know, Queen of Sheba, or others who, the wise men,
yeah.
You know, people from outside, you know, Gentiles who have like this this inclinate, maybe the Queen of Sheba is not the best, you know, when they're, you know, kind of like at the Areopagus, even just like,
yeah.
You know, that an openness to this is something to be considered, and even an acknowledgement of, oh, this must be the God thing, and we don't understand everything about you, but please show mercy and let us know, you know, so we can hold to it.
Yeah, no, and I love the idea. I hadn't tied it to like the wise men, but that's great because you've got, you know, people recognizing something divine here and saying, hey, this is, you know, we don't understand it, but we understand that it's, you know, divine, greater than us, and so let's pray, let's talk to that divinity and say, we don't understand you, tell us more, you know, give us instruction, give us your wisdom. It's a very humble way. I always read that prayer, and I always just saw a very Protestant prayer in it, but it's, yeah. Like,
no, there, I mean, there's very Protestant elements throughout.
Yeah. When I say Protestant, I should clarify, since I'm guessing a lot of our listeners are Lutheran. I generally don't think Lutheran when I say Protestant. I actually think, as a Lutheran, when people call me a Protestant, I often very quick to correct them and say, well, I prefer Lutheran. And one of the main reasons, the easiest reason, I guess, is just to say, well, you know, just structurally, like, I believe in the real presence. So that changes everything. But that's an aside and maybe a different episode altogether. So, yeah, they make this, the leader offers up this prayer, and then his boat is loosed and he's able to row in. And so he does. And on this boat is all of Scripture, and here's the best part: all of Scripture, even some of that hadn't been written yet. So this happens like during the apostolic
age.
And he
specifically mentions Revelation. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, and so which is to say, this was a miracle, right? So this is a myth in like the you know, if we look at it from the sense of just a literary sense, right? It was Bartholomew that had sent it, and he wrote a letter saying, you know, I sent this out. Whoever finds it, I was instructed by God to do this. So Saint Bartholomew is their patron saint of Ben Salem, and it's you know, it's all so it's a very Christian nation, and the sailors are very happy to find that, and that plays a really big part in it. But it leads to this question. I think this is one of the central questions of the text, at least that I think Bacon wants us to ask, is this discussion of philosophy, and when I say philosophy here, I mean science, of course, as we think of it, and as Bacon's trying to push it, and religion. Philosophy and religion, and the fundamental question is which one leads, which one comes first.
And we've had a number of guests on now, and Dr. Henkel's episode will be coming out this week. You know, and we've talked about some of those tensions of, you have some Christians who will say, you know, science as if it's a competitor or it's a some threat, and I think you have plenty in the scientific community who, whether they admit it or not, a conscious bias or unconscious bias, will see one having Christian convictions as, you know, wondering how that doesn't undermine their scientific endeavors. So, you know, it's interesting to see Bacon has already seen possible tensions there and trying to wrestle with, okay, well, as Peter said, which one leads? Which one is going to be carrying the light?
No, and think about this. He's at the beginning of the modern scientific revolution, and he already recognizes this tension there. And so what he's trying to do, if you want to be pessimistic about it, he's basically giving you a propaganda piece saying, look, at Christianity is perfectly compatible with science. There's no problem here, philosophy. There's no problem. We can go this direction, and we can be wonderful.
And indeed, Christianity should impel us
right
to go
this
direction.
Yeah, no, good, yeah. Now if you you could also read it alternatively as him saying, you know, hey, this is this is a problem, so I'm gonna, you know, put it out there and say, you know, make it look like this, even though I realize in the end Christianity's not gonna stand up here, right?
And being that he took bribes, that might not be beyond him.
Yeah, exactly. No, and there are some people that absolutely without a question read him that way and say, oh no, this is a propaganda piece. He's basically saying, this is if we can if I can convince people that this is okay with Christianity, that it's compatible, that then they'll let me do it. But in the end, I know it's not, and I'm gonna, you know, go that. That's you can make up your own mind on that, or, you know, better than that, don't just make up your mind. Think about it and keep reading him and keep reading other people and start thinking about it, because these are the questions that, you know, when there's not a clean answer and a clear answer, it's I think more fun to just, you know, keep thinking about it and keep wrestling with it. And you can have an opinion, but don't let it become a settled opinion until it actually has reason to be settled. So he pushes onto that, but here's the interesting thing. The book remains unfinished, and it's published posthumously, so after he dies.
And maybe just to give a little bit of in between now. So these sailors are they're greeted as the citizens are waving them on, but they're greeted by a group from the island that asks them, you know, why are you coming? You know, do you have sick? Do you have need for supplies? You know, we will help you with these things, but there will be a very limited time that you have to stay with us. And eventually they are then permitted to even come ashore, but I think it's a period of 3 days that they have to stay in the very ample shelter that's provided for them without going outside. But they recognize there's this great hospitality being shown them, but also this kind of secretiveness, would that be the right word?
Yeah.
That they're, you know, they're curious about this society. And slowly they're going to have representatives who come and kind of shed light on some stuff. But maybe just to get to the point of, okay, now they're in this what's called the Stranger House, which is interesting because during the Reformation, when you would have like Zwinglians or people from Switzerland who would come to England under Edward, you would have stranger churches. Mm-hmm. So these are foreigners, right? It's just an English way of saying that. So stranger houses that they'll be in. And that's how they're going to find out about this culture that Peter is talking about. So they are brought onto the island.
Yep.
They are welcomed. And that's how they're going to find out about how these people got the scriptures and things of this nature. So maybe if you want to go from there, Peter.
Yeah, so they're getting the stories then, you know, from their guides or whoever. And as I said, the main one would be this Jew who's given leave to kind of help them out and talk to them and tell them a fair amount of information. As I said, the book isn't completed, and it's published after Bacon dies. And there's this interesting quote in another work of Bacon's called De Augmentis Scientiarum. He says that any work concerning civil knowledge that he wrote would have to be either, quote, abortive or posthumous, which this one is both. And it's about civil knowledge in a sense, because it's about society, right? And so it's not maybe not surprising that that's how this one comes out. But
and I mean, the religious and the civil and the scientific dynamics are all interwoven. I mean, they're cohesive.
Right.
On this island.
Right. And that's actually part of the point, is that science and religion all are part of the culture that are it's baked into the cake, so to speak. And so how does this all work together is really the question. And can it work together? And he's trying to say, of course,
and
yes.
And in service of society.
Yeah. Well, and in service of society and people as individuals, too. Right. So this Salomon's house ultimately is doing all of this scientific research, and he gives, like I said, the last third of the book is one of the main character, the author, or the main character of the, what's it called? I'm having a brain freeze here. The person that's doing the writing.
I can't remember his name, but he's like the head, one of the leaders of the sailors.
Yeah, but he receives an audience with a member of Salomon's house, and so he tells him kind of all these secrets, and then at the end gives him leave to share this information with Europe. Now, I should point out that these scientists in Salomon's house, they go out on these expeditions and they fly under different flags, so that they know all about Europe and all about China and all about the world, and they have, you know, their scientists go out, gather information, come back, and they put it into practice and build on it, and they have all these things. So the idea is that they are not separate from the world, but the world is separate from them, if that makes sense.
And this may be just by way of background. So in these various episodes of some of the you have the guy who's meant to kind of be the ambassador of the Stranger House. You have I can't remember the they do have a Jewish community that's still observing the faith, although he says unlike in Europe it sings the praises of the society in which it finds itself, and of even of the Savior,
of Christianity
to an extent. But he contrasts Bensalem with even with China, and he says, you know, China sails everywhere, but it doesn't allow visitors, and it does so out of you know, fear or inhospitability, and so he's the one representative is trying to explain how they have people there who speak different languages, and they have a diverse population, and yet they're not known to foreign lands. And so what they would do is, they hadn't had people there in a long time, but people would stay in the stranger house, and then they would be given kind of like an advance on how long they could stay, and then that would be extended. And eventually, all but a handful, I believe, had chosen not to return to where they were from.
Right, they stayed.
And even the men who had been on this voyage, when they find out about this, it says that they had a really hard time looking at their boat. You know, they didn't want to head back. And yet they would send out, I don't know if spy is the best word, but essentially that's what they were doing. They would send out ships with people from the House of Solomon who would go and live, I think, for a dozen years, maybe.
I think that's right. Yeah, 12
in a
years.
Foreign land, and
surprising,
would,
it was 12, huh?
I think so. Yeah, and they would disguise them.
For you too.
Yeah, they would disguise themselves, learn the various habits of those people, what they had discovered, and so in the House of Solomon, I believe, you know, there's a statue to Christopher Columbus, mm-hmm. To different inventors. I can't remember, Copernicus or Galileo, maybe, you know, people along those lines.
There would have been like Benjamin Franklin, if we want to be anachronistic.
Yeah, and, you know, so they're gathering knowledge, but secretly, and then they're willing to welcome, but in a way that people don't want to leave. And so this is how they can glean and interact still with the rest of the world. So they're not parochial or insulated, but at the same time, how they can avoid having the rest of the world spoil their happiness.
Yeah, and you can, as far as the story goes, you can take that or leave it and say, well, that's kind of a silly story or whatever. But understand what Bacon's trying to do is he's trying to say this is not a backwards insulated place. This isn't, you know, China. He makes that pretty clear. But he's also trying to say this is...
I think China is lovely, by the way. I just want to make that clear.
Do we have any listeners in China? I haven't checked lately.
I think we might have some. Oh. Japan, we have a lot.
Japan, yeah. We got
but this is just, Bacon is just picking a place,
right,
basically.
No, and I just want to say, to all of our listeners in Japan, we love you, all right? Yeah. Just, you know, send us an email, let us know, right? podcast@letthebirdfly.com. No, Bensalem is not, he's trying to say this is not a backwards place, this is not an isolated place, it's just the opposite. And so he has to create this fictive narrative in order to make that claim, obviously. And so he's doing that, but he's doing it for a reason, and the reason is he wants to advance this argument that these religion, philosophy can all be melded together in society, and it can actually become a wonderful place, a utopia, right? And Wade mentioned at the beginning of the episode, utopia can mean not a place. In Greek, it actually comes from the ou, which means not, and topia, which means place, so not a place, quite literally. But that is not how, you know, I mean, like, Bacon is in a sense kind of arguing like, well, this could be our place. Like, so he's not saying this is that dreamland that we'll never reach. He actually thinks that modern science, as he envisions it, could lead us in that direction. And you can say that's kind of crazy. I think that we've actually kind of imbibed that. I think that we truly believe that. And, you know, Wade's sitting here looking at his iPhone, you know, 8S462 or something. So he's a... I think, well, he probably is happy that he has that and he doesn't have to use a landline or a telegram or, you know, Pony Express.
Although I do use the Telegram app.
That's true. Yeah, it's a little plug for Telegram. So, no, I mean, Bacon is, he's really making the argument, and he's trying to create this place where you could see how this might possibly happen. He's trying to remove the people of his time from their setting and say, just rethink the world. It could be different. And he really does want to rethink the world.
And, I mean, the last maybe 4 or 5 pages are just a cataloging of all the stuff that the House of Solomon is doing, which includes kind of their purpose and then their methodology. And he goes through all the stuff that they're exploring. And then finally their rites. So kind of he comes back to their Christianity and how they're worshiping or the rites they're carrying out. And I think what I found interesting is that I know at the college, one of the things that we've been thinking through, especially in our department, is, you know, how do we express well the value of a Lutheran education, especially for people who aren't Lutheran? And, you know, one of the things that I keep coming back to, and it's often a theme of this podcast, is, you know, a life freely lived, right? That because we have a world given back to us, we have a sense of a vocation. So even someone who might not be Lutheran, we're able to share with them how to serve in the places God has set them for the good of their neighbor. The two kingdoms, how we serve in both realms, so the civil and we might say the religious. But then I also think a curiosity about the world. And, you know, already at Wittenberg, you see this developing at Luther's time, and I believe Luther had wanted to publish the works of Copernicus and things of this nature. And so while this is happening in England, you know, it's definitely, I'm guessing Bacon would have been a member of the Church of England.
Yeah, definitely.
I think what I found fascinating is that, and I know, as Peter mentioned, maybe there's skeptics who say this is just, you know, he's just serving his own purposes here. I found there to be something in here that resonated with me, in that this Christian society, and obviously Protestant, you know, they just magically get the scriptures, and that's all they needed to learn Christianity. In so doing, in that experience, is impelled to want to dig deeper into the world around it, and also to want to structure a society in a way that serves well for the benefit of neighbor. And there's a lot of tensions in here that he doesn't develop or play out. But, you know, kind of just the development of it, you have this encounter and you expect these to be savages, if I can use that word, on this island. You know, you think of, we've been referencing Brave New World, and so you have the savage there. And, you know, then you encounter these people and you think, okay, this is going to be an insulated people. And I mean, even as I'm picturing their dress at the beginning, I'm picturing, you know, kind of like you might picture on a remote island. But as you see the level of sophistication that's taking place, and he's presenting this is not out of line with A, Christianity, or B, a civil European society even, right? This, he's not presenting this as something that's incapable, or that Europeans are incapable of appreciating or trying to put in practice, although he does kind of bash Europe as anyone does when they do write a utopian novel. I guess that stuck out to me. And to see this playing out, you know, after the Reformation is kind of a bridge, and then we know what's going to happen with Enlightenment and everything else. And I mean, I think the Enlightenment, you see, you have this tension then that develops of, well, it's either reason or it's Christianity, and that doesn't work out so well. I mean, the French Revolution's not a great success. and then you kind of see in our own day now this great suspicion, just as there was of Christianity, you know, now largely this great suspicion of reason. I hate to say post-modernity, but, you know, these shifts that take place, to see him as a bridge, and I think is a very optimistic bridge, who in many ways is right about a lot of the things that will develop, at least scientifically.
Yeah, I will say that's really interesting as you get to the end of the book and he goes through these things that, you know, as you read that as a contemporary, not a contemporary of us, not a contemporary of Bacon reader. It's hard because I want to say a modern reader, but then we've been using modern to refer to Bacon, so who knows. But people that are reading right now in the 21st century, you might say, well, okay, yeah, that all makes sense. But you don't realize, like, but these are things that he's anticipating. So when you see something, you're like, well, that's kind of silly. Why would he say that? Obviously, that's not right. Remember that all these other things, he's anticipating all this stuff. This is all stuff that hasn't been tested out and he doesn't realize. So, I mean, he's talking about the different sorts of ways that you might do experiments. And you realize, oh, yeah, there's a lot of that stuff that we do. Like, we found a lot out by that. And I think it's, you know, it's, we've gone too long already, so I should kind of wrap up here. But the reason I told Wade that this might be a good one to read is that partly it's short and it's fiction, so it's easier to read. But it's also a good, you know, kind of in to see just what Bacon's trying to do. if anyone is interested in reading more of Bacon, I would recommend, actually, if you want to kind of get a little bit more into him than just this one work, you could read this on its own, but I would recommend The Great Instauration. If you read that, he goes through six parts of how this instauration will happen, this new beginning is going to happen. And the sixth part he leaves, he says, well, this one, I don't know exactly how it would happen. It's beyond my ability. And one of the editors of a volume that I have, I think very aptly said, the New Atlantis is that sixth part. And so the fact that it's left unfinished makes sense then, maybe deliberately left unfinished, to say, and now we go forward. The cover page to The Great Instauration, in fact, had a picture, a drawing of the Pillars of Hercules, which was the edges of the ancient world. Hercules went to that far, and no one went farther. And Bacon has two ships, actually, on the other side of the Pillars of Hercules, one far back and one just crossing over. And he's saying, we're going beyond where the ancient world took us. We're going to go beyond that. And that's what he's trying to do. And that's what he thinks that we're going to do. And it's interesting because as modern, as beneficiaries of modern science, we definitely see that. And one of the things Bacon really wanted to see was health and life, life extended, health improved. And when we think about modern science, what do we think of? We think about our doctors and our nurses and, IVs and places Wade doesn't want to go. And we
think of that, and maybe some of it think through the lens of some bioethical issues that we face in our own day. But when we think of that through the lens of what life was like still at Sir Francis Bacon's time, this is a very noble thing to want for all people. You know, this is not let's clone people and let's, whatever the case may be. This is let's prolong life. Let's serve our neighbor. I don't want us to anachronistically read back into this, somehow that he is trying to shake his hand at God and by all means less necessary, let's create our heaven here. I mean, he wants a better society, but it is a utopia, right? It's nowhere. Right. But I mean, this is, how can we do these things to help people in our society?
Yeah, no, and I think he definitely wants that. There are scholars who argue that he is, at heart, scholars who can read hearts, they say he's not a Christian and that he doesn't really, he sees the overthrow of Christianity and all of this. But again, that may just be an anachronistic reading. We might be reading back and saying, well, this is what happens. And then we have all these problems for Christianity has to defend itself. And it may not be. I mean, maybe he did see that. I mean, he clearly had a very clear vision of what he wanted and where he saw it would go. I don't know. I don't read hearts, at least not well. I certainly don't can't put myself back in the early 17th century to see how things were back then. But regardless, yeah, you're right. I mean, he's arguing for something that most people would agree with. We should make people healthier, happier, live longer. These are good things. And he's arguing we can do this. We have the ability. The world gives us these things. Now, as Christians, we have the freedom to go and use the world and to do these, right? We're going to, reach out in that regard.
So, and if you listen to the episode that should have come out before this, we can make radioactive chlamydia.
That's right.
For
we can,
benefit
yeah,
of our
sure.
neighbor.
We didn't ask Dr. Henkel if that was for the benefit of our neighbor or not.
We just assumed, I think. But hopefully you listened to the episode before this.
If not, hopefully that's enough to tease you.
Yeah, it was very interesting, and Dr. Henkel did a great job. I will say, Peter referenced reading other works of Sir Francis Bacon, and I would encourage you if you have an interest to do so. I will say, though, as someone who's definitely a layman when it comes to this scholar and a lot of his writings, this is a very accessible work and a quick read for you to read yourself as well, too, if you find it interesting. Maybe you listen to this and you're interested, and you go and you read it, and then you listen again, whatever the case may be, or you find other resources out there. But not a hard read, a quick read, and I think, especially if this is what your appetite a little bit, you'll enjoy it if you like utopian or dystopian fiction.
No, and he's not a bad writer for sure. And that's why I also recommend The Great Instauration, because it's similar. You can follow along. That one's not a novel or a fiction, so it's a little bit more, didactic in that regard. But it's But yeah, it's very accessible. You could follow along pretty well. So yeah, I encourage anyone who's interested to do it. Both of those works are pretty short. My copy actually has them together, and it's easy to get lost on my bookshelf. It's so thin. So yeah, I'll try to remember to link to both of them on the show notes. I'll link to the Gutenberg. I'm pretty sure Gutenberg Project has both of them.
And then if you're also interested at the 60 or 90 second biography of Sir Francis Bacon on YouTube, very, very good.
Okay. Yeah. Wade, you send me that link and I'll put that in there as well.
All right. Peter, anything else, I guess, as you close out? This is kind of your field, and I think you've done a good job explaining. Anything you'd like to take us home with as we close out with regard to this, Bacon's general work or the New Atlantis?
No, I will say that, you know, this transitional period is really interesting to me. Obviously, I was, you know, at one point attempting to write a dissertation on it. So, but it's a period in where, you know, the Western world has a pretty big turn, a pretty big change, and it reminds us that you know, the world really is open to us in a way that that we can reimagine the world, and we can rethink the world, and the world in a very real way changes to us. And yet it's all the world that's been given to us by God in creation, and then ultimately, as we say in the podcast, given back to us by God in Jesus crucifixion and resurrection, right? And so to see this, and you know, if we want to take kind of a positive reading of Bacon and a Christian reading of Bacon, you know, and I have no problem if you don't want to take that, but if you want to take that route, you know, we can see him, he's really kind of championing this, that the world is given back to us. You know, God says, you know, here, the creation is for you, Adam, and Adam messes up, and Christ says, no, it's for you, and it's so much more than you thought it was, right? And so that's the world given back to us, and in a sense, certainly Bacon embraces that.
Well, Peter, I thank you for that, and it was nice to have you be able to bring your background with that, and I hope our listeners have enjoyed it. We'll hopefully have some more of these episodes where we can kind of get into a text we read and hopefully encourage you to read it. And we will also, of course, be sticking with our bread and butter, which is getting guests who know more than us on sometimes,
been.
Too. You might have wondered where all the kids went. As I mentioned, some have gone home. Ziggy and Oliva have still been out here. They found another big stick, I've noticed, that they have been waving and running around with. But maybe if Ziggy and Oliva can make their way over to the mic, they can help us close this out. So whether we live in utopia or not, as we have a world given back to us that we are set free to explore and find big sticks in, which we wave around and then run around the house for some reason, as you were doing, ultimately, what's the main thing in all of this that we can do?
Let the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to cry. I don't care what the people are thinking, I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set him up, another round. I set him up, another round. I set him up, another round. One more round won't get me down. I don't care.